Okay, well, I guess, brethren, if you're like me, you'd probably like to see God's hand in your lives more visibly, God's involvement in your life more visibly. That's what I would like to see, and I think for most of us, we don't. God does not typically turn up visibly in our lives. And sometimes we might even wonder, you know what, is God there? Does God hear me when I pray? Is God involved in my life in any way, shape, or form? Because I don't see him. I don't detect his involvement. That's what we might think. And it'd be great, I suppose, if perhaps, you know, an angel could turn up and visit with us. Think, done, fantastic, I'm happy now. But that's not usually the case, is it? And this, I think, is where we can find the book of Esther in the scriptures, you know, rather helpful for us. Because the book of Esther gives us an understanding of how God often works in the background. Now, what's curious about the book of Esther is that God is not mentioned anywhere. So here we have a book in the Bible, the book of Esther, and nowhere does it mention God. Isn't that curious? You'd think surely a Bible book would talk about God, but it doesn't. And yet it's clear, as we'll see as we go through it in our review today, that God was deeply involved again and again and again, because he was going to save the Jewish people of that day from extermination, from annihilation, from a Holocaust. So God was absolutely involved, and we see the hidden hand of God in the book of Esther. And you can see that by the number of remarkable coincidences that take place. They think, well, that's strange. Well, that's strange. Well, that's unusual. Well, how could that be? And they all line up. Now, if there was one coincidence, you could perhaps make a case and say, well, it's just what happens. Maybe two. Maybe three. But we'll see as we go through the book of Esther, there are many, many remarkable coincidences that cannot, I think, easily be explained away other than behind the scenes, unseen, God was working out the details to deliver his people, the Jews, at that time. And I think the lesson for you and for me is that, well, hold on, if that's how God can work and does work, perhaps I should look at my life and see if there are strange coincidences, remarkable coincidences that aren't actually just coincidences, but are the hand of God working in my life behind the scenes. Could that be? I think the answer is absolutely for sure. You know, it was Albert Einstein that said that coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous, which is quite a clever thought if you think about it. Coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. You don't see him. But how could that come about? That's a strange coincidence. Oh, and there's another one. Behind the scenes, God is at work. So I was asked recently to review the book of Esther, and I thought initially, I don't think so, because it's only about 2 years ago we last went through it, so it's a bit early yet. And then when I went looking for notes and things, I realised it was about 6 years ago, 7 years ago. Clearly time has flown a bit. So I think it's good to review it because, first of all, it's a great story, and a really great story. You could surely do a proper, full-blown Hollywood movie of the Book of Esther. I know they've done a cheap version, which didn't actually follow the story closely at all, and it wasn't a big Hollywood. It was a sort of straight-to-TV type of thing. It's a great story, first of all. It also explains the origins of the Jewish festival of Purim, which is one of their big, fun, frolicking, happy feast days that they have every year in the Jewish community. The festival of Purim comes from the book of Esther. And thirdly, like I said initially, it sort of shows you how coincidences may not always be just that, and how the God himself, the Lord Jesus, can be working in your life or my life if we are just alert enough to spot it, which can be very, very encouraging. So let's open the book of Esther at chapter 1, and we'll read verses 1 through 12 just to get started, get the flow underway. So Esther chapter 1, reading verses 1 through to to 12. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this was the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, that in the third year of his reign he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles, the princes of the provinces being before him, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. This is some feast. What, 6 months? Wow! Now, King Ahasuerus is probably King Xerxes. That's his Greek name. I think he's better known as King Xerxes. He was involved in some famous battles in the past. But King Xerxes, or King Ahasuerus, had this massive party for about 6 months. The timing of this was round about 480 to 470 BC. Quite a long time ago, but let's carry on. Verse 5. When these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days. Separate feast. But this is for the people present in Shushan, the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. So the king actually rules from Shushan. His big palace is there. He's had this 6 months jamboree. Everybody's being pretty happy. Now it's a 7 day, 7 days, locally for the people of Shushan. Verse 6, there were white and blue curtains fastened with cords of fine linen and purple and silver rods and marble pillars. The couches were of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, white and black marble. This is opulent living. I suspect not many of us have homes quite like this. And they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance. I wouldn't mind trying some of that, I've got to say. According to the generosity of the king. In accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory. So if you're a teetotaler, you have no problem. For so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. So far, so good. King is in pretty good spirits. It's early in his reign, and he's throwing a big party. Come on, folks. Look at my glory. Look at my majesty. Come and admire me. And moving on to verses 9 through 12, the problems start to develop. Queen Vashti, his wife and queen, also made a feast for the women in the royal palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the 7th day, so the end of that week festival, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded these characters who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown, in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. Sounds so far okay-ish. The king is showing off everything, his palace, his marble, his statues, great wines to drink, wonderful time. Tell you what, pièce de résistance, let's have my beautiful wife, Queen Vashti, come and parade before everybody and see how beautiful my wife is. Regrettably, verse 12, Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, brought by his eunuchs. Therefore, the king's not very happy. The king was furious, and his anger burned within him. A lot of reasons for that, I suppose, but one is, it's almost like public humiliation. This is the emperor of the Persian Empire. This is the mighty King Xerxes. And he invites his wife to come, and he tells all the guys, the princes, the diplomats, hey, wait till you see my wife. You think your wife might be okay? Catch this. Tell Vashti to come. Put her royal robes on and her special crown. Come on. And she says, you know what, O king, get lost. Oh, that's not going to end well, is it? And that's how the story gets underway. And for a bit of background, this is set in the days of the Persian Empire. You might remember, well, hopefully you're well aware, that the Jewish people had been rather naughty and had been carted off by Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon about sort of 580, 600 BC. Now, after about 70 years of being in captivity, or at least exiled in Babylon, they had the opportunity to return to Jerusalem and to Judea and so on, and a minority did. You can think of people like Ezra and Nehemiah. So a few tens of thousands of the Jewish people went back to the land of Israel, but most didn't. They stayed in what was now Persia, and they were happy there. They'd made homes, they'd set up businesses, their children and grandchildren born there, so they stayed there. And there were now lots and lots of Jewish people spread all around the Persian Empire. They had not gone back to the Holy Land. Not quite sure how God thought about that. I would have thought he might be a bit disappointed that they weren't returning to Mount Zion. But anyway, this is where they are. That's where the story takes place. The Jewish people living scattered across the entire Persian Empire. So here's the story. Queen Vashti has, in a sense, publicly affronted the king. Not something you really want to do in those days, I would have thought. Let's pick up the story, verses 13 through 18. The king said to the wise men who understood the times, verse 14, those closest to him being Karshina and Shethar and a few others, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who had access to the king's presence and who ranked highest in the kingdom. So the top seven leaders in the entire empire. He said, verse 15, what should we do to Queen Vashti according to law? Can't just make rules up. Because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus brought formally by the eunuchs. When this is an affront. This is unbelievable. And Memucan, one of these seven wise characters, answered before the king and princes, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women. Ooh. So that they will despise their husbands in their eyes when they report King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she did not come. She told her to go ride his bike. Wow, this is not good. This very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they have heard of the behavior of the queen. There will be excessive contempt and wrath. So these guys are saying, this is not just you, O king, but certainly you've been affronted here, but actually, Queen Vashti is a sort of a role model. You know, once it gets into the magazines and goes out on Twitter, everybody knows what the queen has done to you, almighty king. Well, think of all the wives that they'll tell their husbands to get lost. If she can tell the king to get lost, I can tell you to get lost. So they're concerned. Rebellion among the women. Verse 19 through 21. If it pleases the king, this is their advice, or at least Memucan's advice, if it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him. Let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes. And of course, the law of the Persians and the Medes cannot be changed. You'll recollect the story of Daniel ending up in his lion's den because a law was passed that even the emperor can't revoke. And that's the law of the Medes and Persians. When it goes out, it's out. It's done. No way back. So that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So, excommunicate her. She's gone. She's out of it. She's no more. She's a has-been. When the king's decree, which he will make, is proclaimed throughout all his empire, it's a great empire, all wives will honour their husbands, both great and small. Because if that happens to the queen,
uh-oh.
Then we've got no chance, have we? So we'll be more respectful to our husbands. This was the logic. And the reply pleased the king and the princes, and the king did according to the words of Memucan. So, they explain that Queen Vashti is finished as queen. She's pensioned off somewhere, never to be seen again, right? And This is interesting. Now, if you know the story of Esther and how it works out, you'll realize there's things afoot here. If you've not read the story of Esther, this is the first chapter you read. It doesn't mean a lot, but you and I know there's more to this because here a vacancy has just rather strangely appeared. The queen's role is vacant. The existing queen, who's not old, who's not been killed, has been effectively deposed, and now there's a vacancy for a new queen. A new person who would be very close to the mighty king. And that's just appeared. Now, because at this stage, there's no known risk to the Jewish people. They've been here for over 100 years, right? Or about 100 years. So there's no risk. There's no danger. Yet, of course, we know that, you know, God has great foresight. So God knows, this is my take on it anyway, God knows that there's things going to happen. Great danger is on the horizon for the Jewish people. And it would make sense for God to start to move his pieces on the chessboard to make sure that deliverance can be provided. Now, so here in chapter 1, there's no reference, is there, to any God? There's no reference here to any prophet, but just unusually, a vacancy has arisen right next to the mighty king. Okay, let's look at chapter 2, read verses 1 through 4. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. Well, after these things, appears to be about 3 to 4 years, and historically this is the time when King Xerxes, Ahasuerus, went off to battle and tried to defeat Greece and sort of failed. It was a massive defeat for him. If you heard about the 300 Spartans, the battle at Thermopylae and so on, that was here. So he retreated back home, you know, a bit of a bloody nose, and let's get back to domestic affairs. And now it says he remembers Queen Vashti, and people think, well, maybe he was having second thoughts. Maybe it was a bit harsh. I mean, she was a lovely woman, and she was queen, and deposed her. I wonder if I should perhaps think about maybe, and that'd be bad news if you're one of the advisors, because you all know the saying, hell hath no fury, like a woman scorned. If Queen Vashti was allowed back, the thinking would be she'd make sure she took vengeance on these wise men who had suggested her being deposed. So, good idea is let's make sure we divert the attention of the king. And here they come with a great project. Verse 2. Then the king's servants who attended him said, don't worry about Vashti, almighty king. Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan the citadel, into the women's quarters, under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen, instead of Vashti. This thing pleased the king, and he did so. You think, well, I guess it might. I mean, the king's probably still a reasonable age. And the idea of what, well, the most beautiful young women in the entire empire brought here, a beauty parade. And I can look at them and think, beautiful, gorgeous, wonderful, oh, eye-popping. And one of them can be my new queen. Great idea. Go for it, boys. Right? So this so far just looks like relatively normal activity if you're a despotic emperor. But dropping down verses 5 and then 7. Now in Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Keshe Benjamite. I think we once had a little goldfish called Mordecai.
We did.
He was quite a pleasant goldfish, I've got to say, but eventually passed on to where goldfishes go. So two key people are introduced here. Mordecai, the Jew, living in Shushan, verse 7. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, so she'd been orphaned. And the young woman, thankfully, was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. Just as well that she was lovely and beautiful, if she'd been sort of plain Jane, the story might have worked out quite as well as it did, right? But it worked out pretty well. Now, obviously, Esther and Mordecai are cousins, although there are some traditions based on some versions that say uncle and niece, but the New King James and most versions say, you know, we're talking of cousins here. Now, Esther, her name in Jewish and Hebrew is Hadassah, which means myrtle, and Esther is Persian for star, as the stars in the sky. But strangely enough, Esther in Hebrew comes from a Hebrew root meaning something hidden or something concealed, which is interesting because, first of all, as we'll see, Esther is concealed or hidden as a Jewess. Doesn't become evident for quite some time. And of course, the whole book of Esther shows us a God who is hidden. We never see God visibly. God is never mentioned in the book of Esther. So God himself is something hidden, something concealed. Esther remains something concealed, at least for quite a while. So an interesting play on her name there. Let's drop down and read verses 8 through 10. So it was when the king's command and decree were heard that many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. It says, you know, many young women. One tradition says there were about 400, which is quite a lot of women to get through, I would have thought.
You can't cope with one.
Yeah, I find one a struggle. Now, the young woman, talking of Esther, who had been brought in as well, like I say, just as well she was good-looking. Just another coincidence. Now, the young woman pleased him, talking of Esther, and she obtained his favour. So he readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance, so she got more than normal. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. So she gets great favour with this guy that is the custodian. Great favour. Wonder how that came about. Well, of course, you could say she's just a lovely looking woman. She's a very pleasant personality. She's a big smile. Of course, in isolation, it could just be one of those things. But great favour, which works towards a certain end here. Just another thing that just happens. Verse 10, Esther had not revealed her people or kindred, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. We don't know why, but at this stage, Esther is something hidden, something concealed. She's told no one that she is a Jew or a Jewess. All right? Verses 12 through 14. Each young woman's turn came to go into King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months' preparation, according to the regulations for the women, for thus were the days of their preparation apportioned. 6 months was oil of myrrh, 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. I have no idea on earth what those could be, but presumably it was deemed to be something, you know, very important or necessary. So this is the process that goes through. Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters to the king's palace. In the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of this other character, Sheazgaz, the king's eunuch, who kept the concubines, because she was now no longer a young virgin, she was now potentially a concubine. And she would not go to the king again, unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name, which I guess didn't happen very often. So you're almost, in a sense, in a sort of state of widowhood here. You've been with the king one night, and now you're off to the other place where you might well stay. You could clearly never get married to anybody else, because if you're the king's concubine, that's you, right? So in some ways, quite sad, I would have thought, for many of these women. So verses 15 through 20. Now, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter to go into the king, She requested nothing but what Hegai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So again, maybe that's just natural. Maybe she's just a very beautiful woman with a fantastic personality and exudes happiness and joy and everybody just loves her. Or is there something else just creating this great attraction that she has in people's minds? So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus, verse 16, into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. So a few years have passed along since the beginning, starting year 3 of his reign, chapter 1, now in year 7, so 4 years have elapsed since we started this story. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the Feast of Esther, can you believe, for all his officials and servants, and proclaimed a holiday in the provinces, the entire empire, and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. So, it just happens, right? That of all the beautiful women selected from around the entire Persian Empire, it just happens that the king says, you know what, this girl is something super special. I really feel attracted to her. She's the one. She's the one who's selected to be my new queen. So, just a coincidence? You could say so. I mean, she might be one of 400, so statistically it might be possible. But you can see too many things happening here. Create the vacancy for a queen. Ensure that Esther is a beautiful young unmarried woman. Have her such that she receives favor wherever she goes. Into the heart and mind of the king, she's the one for me. And now, rather remarkably, you have a young, beautiful Jewess as queen of King Ahasuerus, as the queen of Persia. How does that come about? You know, you can see here, I think that, you know, God is carefully lining up the ducks. He's moving his pieces into position, you know, ready for things that haven't yet become apparent, as God can do. Look at chapter 2.
We're in chapter
2, verses 21 to 23. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, meaning that he was in the area of government, a bit like a sort of parliament, sort of court system. So Mordecai's, you know, got reasonable status after a fashion in the king's, you know, general governing area. In those days, while Mordecai, her uncle, sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So they're plotting to assassinate the king. Doesn't say why, but something had upset them clearly. So the matter became known to Mordecai. And we don't know how. Doesn't say there. Some people think that Mordecai overheard them plotting. One tradition is that they were speaking in their own language. Didn't realize that Mordecai was nearby, actually being a bit of a scholar, understood their language and thought, uh-oh. Or perhaps somebody else found out and brought the story to Mordecai. But again, just happens that the story becomes known to Mordecai, who is, of course, uncle to Queen Esther. Verse 22. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther. Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed. And both these guys were hanged on a gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Fantastic, right? So Mordecai just happens to be the key man who brings about the safety and deliverance from assassination of the king. What marvelous opportunity to really give great rewards to Mordecai. But they forgot. It just so happens that they overlooked rewarding Mordecai at this time. And the fact that they overlooked that happens to work out much, much, much better for the Jewish people. So what happened? I don't know. They wrote it down in the chronicles in the book. You know, Mordecai brought this story to us. We checked it out. These two guys were really, you know, rough lot. They were plotting to assassinate the king. All goes down in the book. And of course, typically at that point, you say, well, let's make sure we reward this guy. He deserves something special for what he's done for us. They forgot. They overlooked. Did something distract them? So they looked elsewhere, went to something else and forgotten? You would think so. Look at chapter 3, verses 1 through 6. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman,
the baddie,
the enemy. Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. They've always been enemies of the Jews. And advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. So Haman goes to the top of the totem pole. Haman is your man. Outside of the king, Haman has complete authority almost. He's like the prime minister reporting to the king. So he's the top dog. He's got a lot of authority and a lot of power, a lot of influence. He's a mighty man in the Persian Empire. At least he is at the moment. And the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Naughty Mordecai. Then the king's servants who were within the king's gate said to Mordecai, why do you transgress the king's command? Now it happened when they spoke to him daily and he would not listen to them that they told it to Haman, to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai told him he was a Jew. So it certainly implies there that Mordecai wouldn't bow down because of his religious understanding. Now, it might well be that, I mean, I think Mordecai would have given us a normal gesture of courtesy if called upon, like we all would. This looks like it might have been a special sort of bow, a type of reverence not really deserved of anybody other than, you know, God in heaven. So clearly Mordecai says, I'm a Jew, we don't do that particular type of bow. So off with you. Verse 5. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. Don't you realize how important I am? I'm second in line to the king. How dare you not bow down and crawl before me? But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they told him of the people of Mordecai. He's a Jew. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. So all of a sudden, we've gone from a simple little story of Esther becoming queen, unusual, but statistically there might be some possibility. But now we've got a major problem. Now the Jewish people, everywhere by the looks of it, across the entire empire, are in trouble because Haman wants to slaughter every last one of them and wipe out the Jewish people. Now, that is a problem, right? And of course, what we don't see here either is that Satan is hidden. Was this just Haman? I don't think so. Who's hated the people of Israel, the people of Judah, forever? Satan the devil. Through which line will the Messiah, the Savior, come? Through Judah. Has Satan not always wanted to destroy the Jewish people back in these times to prevent the birth of Messiah? So almost certainly somebody else hidden is Satan behind the scenes. Let's read verses 7 through 9. So again, he's got it in his mind now, Haman, to destroy these people. That's it. This guy won't bow to me. He won't do me homage. I'm such a super important person. I'm insulted and offended. I'm going to destroy 2 million people, whatever the number was. I mean, you got to think about it. Hey, man, really? You're so precious about yourself that you want to kill 2 or 3 million people because some guy doesn't bow to you? What sort of maniac are you? Well, a maniac in whom, you know, Satan might well dwell. Verses 7 through 9. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, a few more years have passed, they cast Pur, That is the lot. And the plural of poor is Purim. You add an I-M, and that means lots, plural. And of course, we're talking here about the origin of the Feast of Purim, the Festival of Purim, one of the happiest, most fun-filled Jewish festivals, right? And this is where it all starts from. So they cast Pur, that is a lot, before Haman to determine the day and the month when it's all going to happen. We're going to slaughter this bunch until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So notice here, they start casting the lots, casting the Pur, in the first month. And when they finish throwing these dice around, wherever it was, it lands on the 12th month. Now, isn't that a happy coincidence that it's not 4 weeks later when it'd be too soon to really do an awful lot to protect the Jewish people? But now suddenly we've got an 11-month gap, which gives God and others plenty of time to work out the solution necessary. So that's a coincidence, isn't it? Just happens to give you 11 months to play with, rather than sort of 3 weeks later or something. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom." Doesn't identify them. Doesn't say, you know, the Jews, which are everywhere, that crowd. He just says, oh, there's a certain people. There are some folk out there. Their laws are different from all other people's. They do not keep the king's laws. Undoubtedly a lie. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work, to bring it into the king's treasuries. Now, my margin says that's about $4 billion, which obviously Haman would get from confiscating all the property of the Jewish people, handing that over, right? It wouldn't be his own money. So destroy them. This is like the Holocaust, isn't it? This is Haman's final solution, something like 470-odd BC. It wasn't just the Second World War and the Holocaust that threatened the existence of the Jewish people. This was, in its day, probably bigger, because all the Jews everywhere were going to be subject to this order to destroy. See, I think you can see Satan's there, and Haman's certainly a very wicked sort of person. And it just happens to be, like I say, a lucky coincidence that there's an 11-month gap. It reminds me of a Proverbs 16:33, which I'll just read to you rather than turning there. Proverbs 16:33, if you take notes, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. You throw the dice in a situation like this. When you go to Las Vegas to a casino and throw the dice, you get what you get. But like this, you throw the dice looking for some sort of, you know, guidance, and you know, God's involved there. And I'm sure God made sure that the delay was more than ample, even allowing for hiccups. Let's read verses 10 to 15. So the king took his signet ring from his hand, gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. Boo, hiss. And the king said to Haman, "The money and the people are given to you. Do with them as seems good to you." Well, obviously these sort of kings were probably in many ways, you know, fairly despotic, not too fussed. If my prime minister, who runs my empire, says he needs to dispose of some bunch of people, get on with it. It's your job. I've got wine to drink and other things to do and horses to ride and got to go and hunt lions. Get on with it. Don't bother me any longer. That's sort of what you did in those days. Then the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written according to all that Haman commanded, to the king's satraps, the governors who were over each province, to the officials of all people, to every province, according to its script, to every people in their language. In the name of King Ahasuerus it was written and sealed with the king's signet ring. And the letters were sent by couriers, UPS, all the rest of them, into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, to annihilate, to exterminate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women. No escape in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. So there you are, 11 months' time, on the 13th day of the 12th month, in that one day, all Jews, babies, young children, infants, old widow ladies, the lot, wipe them out in the name of King Ahasuerus. The law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be changed. A copy of the document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all people, from India to Ethiopia, remember, that they should be ready for that day. The couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan, of course, the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink. Yeah, job done. But the city of Shushan was perplexed. The margin says, in confusion. Well, we all know Jewish people and they're good traders, and this Jewish guy teaches my child how to play the guitar and looks after my young one and is my nurse. And what's this all about? The Jews are a fine bunch of folk. So the people are confused, perplexed, right? Look at chapter 4 then. Let's read verses 1 to 3. When Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city. He cried out with a loud and bitter cry because, what? My entire people? Us, all of us, to be destroyed? And how could we fight back? The Jewish people are in exile. They don't have armies. They don't have a leader. Mordecai is not the leader of the Jewish people, I don't think. He's just a guy that's got a reasonable position in the king's court. There's no defense. We don't have armies. We haven't got a leader. We're just traders and farmers. We grow grapes and we teach music and what? That's us. We're finished. He went as far as the square in front of the king's gate, but not any further, for no one might enter the king's gate, so the parliament area, clothed with sackcloth. And in every province where the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes and fasting because, nightmare, how can we escape? What can be done for us, right? Verses 4 through 12. So Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her about Mordecai being out there in sackcloth and ashes. And the queen was deeply distressed. Then she sent garments to clothe Mordecai, proper clothes for my uncle, and to take his sackcloth away from him, but he would not accept them, not having them. I'm in sackcloth for a reason. Then Esther called Hathak, I guess, one of the king's eunuchs, whom he had appointed to attend her, and she gave him a command concerning Mordecai to find out what's going on. So Hathak went out to Mordecai in the city square that was in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him, and the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the written decree for their destruction, which was given at Shushan, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, and that he might command her to go into the king to make supplication and plead before the king for her people. So take this note, it's got the decree on it, take it to Esther, you know, my cousin, my niece, and tell her to read it, and tell her to go and see the king, and ask that we be freed from this terrible decree. So Hathak returned and told Esther the words of Mordecai, and Esther spoke to Hathak and gave him a command to bring back to Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court of the king who has not been called, has not been invited, has but one law: put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. Yet I myself, for example, she says, have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. So, well, the kings were, well, I won't say busy men necessarily, but obviously they liked their privacy, liked their time off, listening to some decent music, whatever. And if you just walked into the king and he felt in a bit of a mood that day, take that person away and chop the head off, right? He might occasionally think, nothing else to do at the moment, I think I'll find out what this is all about, and he'd hold out the golden scepter, and that meant you would live, right? So it was very dangerous to just walk in the king. And she says, actually, it's a month since I last saw the guy. So when might I see him again? Another month? 2 months? Who knows? With these sort of kings. And if I go in before that, right? So they told Mordecai Esther's words. Then Mordecai told him to answer Esther in this manner. Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. Don't think you can hide from this, Esther. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet, who knows, when you think about it, whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. So interesting sort of few words here. Mordecai clearly believes that relief and deliverance will come somehow from somewhere. He says, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews. Now, I can only guess that Mordecai believes the Jews of that special place, and that the Messiah must be born from the house of David, from the Jews, and that somehow God will do something. Even there, of course, God's not mentioned. It doesn't say there God will bring relief by some other means. God's hidden. God's not mentioned in this book. There's one other book where God's name doesn't appear. That's the Song of Solomon. But it probably wouldn't in that book, thinking about it. But here we are. There will be deliverance. But if you think you can hide, be silent, lass, you'll die. And yet, he said, when you think about it, Esther, who knows whether you have come to the kingdom to be its queen for such a time as this? Isn't this almost, my cousin, providential? You are the right person in the right place at the right time. What an incredible coincidence. A Jewish girl is queen of Persia at just the time that someone decides to exterminate and annihilate all the Jews. What's the chances of that sort of happening? Well, of course, the answer is there's no chance of that happening other than by somebody being very careful out there. You know, the chessboard, and you're making your moves and thinking ahead several moves. If God's the great chess master here, he's putting his pieces and places out to deliver his people. And if you think about it, on a chessboard, what's the most powerful piece? In reality, the queen, right? Queen Esther is the most powerful person here. You could say the king, but the queen does all the work, typically. So it's decision time for young Esther. It's do or die. She knows if she walks into the king, and she needs to try and get this underway, she has a chance of being, you know, killed, beheaded, executed. Yeah, I don't think it's far from guaranteed, because she's a lovely young woman. The king greatly favours her. It's certainly possible that she would walk in unannounced, uninvited, and he might say, well, oh, hi, Esther, come on over here. Let's have a sandwich together and have a chat. That could have happened. But equally, he might decide otherwise. That's probably a bit unpredictable with these sort of kings, right? And she will know, as probably, you know, Mr. Mordecai knows, that in Ecclesiastes, there's a time to be silent, and there's a time to speak. This is not the time to be silent, right? So let's read verses 15 through 17. Then Esther told them to return this answer to Mordecai. Go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so, when we've done that, I will go to the king, uninvited, which is actually against the law. And if I perish, I perish. So it is quite courageous, really. She's still got, of course, a very young woman here, probably, what, early 20s? Then Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. And of course, you can see here that they're not irreligious, these people. If you're talking of fasting for 3 days and three nights, that's a religious observance, isn't it? They're clearly entreating, you know, God. Even though God's not mentioned anywhere, that was hidden hands behind the scenes doing things. Clearly they are looking to God. They're fasting to try and entreat, implore, you know, God's help here, which is good. Right, so let's move on to chapter 5, verses 1 through 3. Now it happened on the third day, I guess after the fasting, that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, across from the king's house, while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house, facing the entrance of the house. So it was, when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, thankfully, she found favour in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden sceptre that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the sceptre. So, of course, that's quite likely to happen. But it did happen, and it could have gone wrong. We can see the king's in really good spirits, reading verses 3 here. And the king said to her, "What do you wish, queen? What is your request? I tell you what, it shall be given to you up to half my kingdom." Right? So he's in a really good mood. That's quite a generous offer, right? Yeah, I don't think it's to be taken literally. It doesn't mean he'll give half the kingdom. It's probably an idiom. It just means, "I'm in a great mood today. Ask whatever you want, and within reason, you'll get it."
No, I'm bad.
Right? And so he's in a very good mood then, right? That's a pretty generous offer for the king, who has the entire empire in his control, to say, "I'll give you almost anything you want." And this idiom, up to half the kingdom. Now, of course, she's a charming woman, and it's quite likely he would have held the golden scepter out, but it's not guaranteed. I mean, he might have had a lousy night. Perhaps he'd heard news about some defeat of his armies, some far-off place, and feeling really bad-tempered. Maybe he had a toothache all night long. I've slept all night long, and what was that woman doing here? Take her out and kill her. Right? But as it happens, Esther, lass, come on over. I'll give you anything you want. Just happened that way. Right? So pretty encouraging. There's a scripture in Proverbs 21:1, which we're not turning to, which reads, "The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. Like rivers of water, he turns it wherever he wishes." Right? Proverbs 21:1. The king's heart is in the hands of the Lord. Like rivers of water, and the Lord turns it wherever he wants. So the king, Esther, on you come. Right? So pretty good. Let's read verses 4 through 8. "So Esther answered, 'This is my super request from such a generous offer, my husband. If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him.' And the king said, 'Done.'" All right. And of course, he does things in a hurry. "Bring Haman quickly, that he may do as Esther has said." So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. So is this it? She's going to ask the king to save her and her people. "At the banquet of wine, the king said to her, 'What is your petition? It shall be granted you. What is your request? Up to half my kingdom.' It shall be done." That's twice he's made that pretty big promise. And we'll see he's going to do it one more time. So I think when the king Ahasuerus makes a promise publicly three times, you know he's going to go through with it, right? "Then Esther answered and said, 'Please save us all.'" She didn't. She said, "My petition request is this. If I have found favour in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfil my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet which I'll prepare for him, for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said. You get something tomorrow." So, what's happened here? She's got the king. He's promised twice now to give her almost anything she wants. And she says, "Tell you what, let's leave it till tomorrow. I'd like to have another banquet tomorrow and invite you both back." why the delay? Now, it's not clear, right? Did she plan to postpone the request for another day? Was that her plan? Did she perhaps feel a bit nervous, thinking, oh, this is going to be really tricky. I'm not sure if I can go through with it. I felt quite confident, but now I'm feeling a bit, oh, I don't know really. Come back tomorrow, O King and Haman, and I'll tell you then. Who knows why? But it just turns out that this delay of one day is probably about the biggest, most important factor in the story. Right? Because it allows for another two or three coincidences to just happen to almost totally guarantee the deliverance of the Jewish people, right? Verses 9 through 14. So Haman went out that day joyful. I'm the most important person in the empire, really more important than the king, but he's got the position. But I'm just mighty and wonderful, and everybody bows down and scrapes to me. I'm the great. And look, I've just been invited to a private banquet of wine with the king and his beautiful queen. There is nobody like me in the entire land. He's walking on air. So Haman went out that day joyful with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai, that Jew, in the king's gate, and that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. And of course, he had been already. That's why the Purim, that's why the Jews were to be slaughtered in a few months' time. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. He sent and called for his friends, his wife Zeresh, going to tell him all the great things I'm famous for now. Then Haman told him of his great riches, the multitude of his children, all the ways in which the king had promoted him, how he had advanced him above officials and servants of the king. I'm the greatest of them all. Moreover, Haman said, besides, that wasn't enough, folks. Queen Esther invited no one. Got that? No one. But just me and the king to a personal private banquet with her. And tomorrow, you know what? I'm going back again. Envy, envy me, envy me. Autographs later. What a man I am. Yet, all this avails me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai, the Jew, sitting there in the king's gate. Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends, who appear to be, you know, birds of a feather, flocked together, said to him, well, tell you what, let a gallows be made, 50 cubits high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet. And Haman thought, what a brilliant idea. I'm so glad I got friends like you. So it pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. And of course, Haman knows he's going to get what he asked for, because the king's just signed off recently, slaughtering all the Jews. He doesn't know their identity, of course, but a certain people. He signed that off quickly enough. If Haman says, there's a guy here who's a real troublemaker, I want to have him executed today, the king's not going to be too fussed. He's just going to say, well, you know what, why not? You're the prime minister, you know all this stuff. You know, I've got some horse riding to do, I'm going to go fishing later, there's some great trout in a nearby stream, and I've got a new fishing rod and new fly for it. So I'm busy today, you're going to execute this guy if you want. I have complete confidence in you. So if this had just happened, Mordecai would be toast, because the king would have no reason, really, not to. Just say, get on with it, right? Doesn't happen. Has this delay of come back tomorrow for my next banquet, has that any part to play in the salvation of the Jewish people? Well, come back next week, and we'll continue with part two of the story of Esther and the hidden God.